Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Well, hello and welcome to the Angus Table today. Today's episode is a little different than our usual episodes. We have the privilege of having one of the directors of Weatherby Scientific on the podcast today. Paul Flynn, welcome to the podcast, Paul.
Thank you, Scott, and delighted to be on board.
It's a different podcast because this is the beginning of a new relationship with Angus Australia. We've had, for many years, two genomic service providers, which is Zoetis and Neogen Australasia, but we're just embarking on this new partnership with Weatherby's from Ireland. So it's a chance to do a podcast so that Paul can explain a bit about Weatherby's and start what we hope is a journey that will last many years. So Paul, thanks for jumping on the podcast today. First of all, can you tell me what your role is? As I understand it, you sit on the Weatherby Scientific board, but you might outline your other roles in the business and a little background about Weatherby Scientific.
Thanks, Scott. So maybe I might just step back some 250 years to start at the beginning of the Weatherby's journey, and to give you a sense about what Weatherby's are about, but where they've come from, and how Weatherby Scientific fits into that journey, let's say within our present day business operations. So Weatherby's is a 250-year-old seventh generation family owned business. When we step back to the late 1700s, the progenitor of the Weatherby's business, James Weatherby, at the time saw the need for a stud book registration within the equine thoroughbred foal crop. And essentially, the objective of that stud book was to rid the evil of false pedigree recording and to ensure the integrity and continued accurate documentation of the thoroughbred pedigree records for newborn foals against nominated sires and dams. So that, in its first instance, was a pedigree-based paper manuscript, which you had newborn foals and documented sires and dams for the first time ever documented in a manuscript. And Weatherby's, as a business, still holds that stud book in the UK and Ireland. And even those early day manuscripts sit within the main headquarters in Wellingborough in the UK. So obviously, across the 250-odd years, the means and approach of documenting and maintaining that stud book has changed. And specifically in the last 40 years, in the mid-1980s, Weatherby's noticed that the emergence of technologies such as molecular technologies and serological technologies could potentially complement how those pedigree records were verified within the stud book. So, for example, you may have nominated sires and dams for newborn foals. However, now in from the mid-1980s onwards, the technology was there to enable and on the side or in parallel test to confirm that parentage using those molecular technologies such as serology, blood typing, and molecular DNA technology as we know and use now. So Weatherby's then leveraged that technology by setting up a laboratory in Ireland in the mid-1980s. That technology then was initially used to carry out parentage verification in the equine thoroughbred foal crop. Very quickly, though, we realized as a business that technology was not just specific to equine. It was more so species agnostic. There was an obvious or natural potential for that technology to serve species such as bovine, and other species that could leverage and utilize DNA technology to verify their emerging herd book and stud books too. So that kind of, I suppose, springboards us into our present day current service offerings as how we stand now as a multi-species geotyping service provider. And of course, we not only offer those services into the UK and Ireland, we have subsequently expanded globally, inclusive of into the Australian territory.
Well, that's quite a story. That's really, your company is as old as Australia is itself.
True. Yes. Yeah. Look, it's been quite a journey. And I suppose that does, you know, that timeline and legacy, it very much aligns with traditional organizations and breed societies, let's say like Angus. And, you know, we're very mindful of, the timeline of your territory, but also the breed Angus. And, you know, you also as a breed have celebratory events in terms of we partner very closely with your partner organizations, Aberdeen Angus UK. And we note that they're also celebrating their 150th anniversary of bird recognition. So, you know, there's a lot of synergies there in terms of those legacy histories and appreciating that, you know, they don't build up overnight and they take time to build. And what comes with that are a lot of facets and values that we've seen come out of those 250 years our side in terms of trust and integrity and governance.
And that's really quite a strong legacy. And Paul, we recently hosted you here at the Angus Australia office, and it was great to have you come out and have a bit of time with the team and get to know our industry. What would you say is one of the key differences that Weatherby's as a genomic service provider brings to the market over potentially some of your competitors there? Why are you different, Paul?
Well, I suppose, Scott, as I mentioned, you know, we've been 40 years in this laboratory business game and have gathered a lot of experience and have stayed very close to what our customers require, what the industry needs in general, and where the industry is heading towards. So we as a business continuously focus on ensuring our service capabilities are based on those, you know, on those understandings of what the market needs are. We don't tend to get too caught up in, you know, what our competitors are doing. We're very confident within our own swim lane to understand that this is what the market needs and this is where we need to focus and ensure that our technology and service offerings are spot on. So we do really pride ourselves in, you know, a range of facets that we built up around our stratified genotyping products, ensuring we deliver those in a high quality manner, and that service delivery is also coupled with really good customer care. I suppose if there was anything technical you might call out, Scott, in terms of potential product differentiators or business ethics, we really value data ownership and ensure that remains within the your ownership of our customers, and also we're yes, we're very stratified in terms of our genotyping service offerings. However, we are very agnostic and open to, let's say, integrating with multiple data integration platforms, third parties such as genomic evaluation centers or any support database frameworks that our customers may be prone into.
No, that's a good answer. I think that's what indeed I was trying to tease out there, was that you're very focused on what you do there. That impressed us when we started to talk with Weatherby's, that you stick to your lane, and also that data ownership is important as an organisation to us. We were very pleased with your position there, and also the fact that Weatherby's also, they're not competing with other providers of genetic evaluation services. And providing those evaluations, rather you concentrate on what you do well and provide those services. So we were delighted with some of that strategic overview, I guess, Paul.
Yeah, okay. There does appear to be a great alignment there, and I suppose it's exciting to be able to take this next step, Scott, and that you would be aware that Weatherby Scientific, we have been, you know, trading within the Australian territory for over 10 years now, and there's always been a kind of an open door relationship with ourselves and Angus Australia, and I suppose as of late and recently that relationship has quickly evolved now that our our technology and our service offerings have come to a point that very much align with Angus Australia's requirements. And, you know, there's an apparent synergy there, whereby, you know, for example, our service offering covers all the main arm suite requirements from our workhorse chip products, SNP chip products, and I can talk about that later on, but also down to the very kind of niche aspects of the Angus Australia service requirements, like the traits, such as myostatin specific variants, those traits, the polar markers, the fawn calf, the curry calf, the possibly lesser requested type traits that they're now part of our standard hat capabilities within Weatherby Scientific, and obviously very much a service requirement of Angus Australia.
Yeah, no, that's a great overview. Just in terms of, some of the listeners might be interested in some of the other sorts of industries agriculturally that you provide genomic services to. Do you want to just give us a quick overview of the types of species that you operate across?
Sure. Yes, happy to do so. So, yeah, you know, I mentioned the term we keep in our swim lane there earlier on, but it's, you know, even within the vein of genotyping, that swim lane is quite broad. So, you know, when we talk about industries in general, and maybe we keep that lens of genomics and genotyping in mind, if we were to take other industries that we are currently involved within, and we maybe start domestically, we have some really nice headline projects and partnerships that we have on board here, whereby we partner very closely with the Irish Cattle Breeding Federation, who are an organization who are overseeing the rollout of a program, the National Genotyping Program here, which I'm sure will be of interest to your listeners to understand the theme of that program and the value of it, whereby ICBF are aiming to essentially genotype the complete herd within Ireland, and working towards genotyping all newborn calves within a yearly calving cycle. So, you know, the overall objective there is to ensure that the opportunity being that for both dairy and beef, that they, you know, can potentially accelerate the rates of gain within our national breeding indexes, and ultimately, you know, enhance farm and farm sustainability, carbon emissions, etc. So the breeding objectives there are obviously very relevant to present day global and environmental challenges. However, the project variables behind it are enormous, in that, you know, we talk about genotyping a complete herd here in Ireland. That is potentially 2.4 million newborn calves every year, of which, you know, ICF are currently genotyping about nearly a million, or just over a million of those calves every year. So, you know, getting towards that 2.4 million number. However, that's a very intense piece from a genotyping perspective. And as a partner to ICBF, we have tooled up our genotyping service capabilities to be able to cater for, example, receipt of 100,000 samples within 1 week during what will be a very intense spring calving cycle, and again then across the course of the year to be able to support a genotyping process that ultimately sees nearly over 1 million samples genotyped a year. So that's just a typical theme of the scale and type of genotyping projects that we partner here domestically. Similarly, within sheep, we, again, domestically, Sheep Ireland, we partnership with, who are utilizing same genomic technologies and have similar breeding objectives, as I mentioned, to ICBF. And again, just from an Australian perspective, we as a genotype service provider can utilize those same technologies for, as we what we do in the sheep, and to be able to feed into, let's say, MLA Meat and Livestock Australia or sheep genetics type models. Jumping about a bit, but, you know, we covered cattle there, we covered sheep, maybe just horses might be of interest as well, Scott. So look, there's obviously a natural affiliation there, considering the Weatherby's background or pedigree within the equine world. And we operate very comfortably in the thoroughbred world and also the non-thoroughbred world in terms of offering our genomic services for both non-thoroughbred and thoroughbred. What is probably an interesting piece to call out there, Scott, is that it's a paradigm moment for the equine. And you know, yourselves and your listeners are very au fait with genomics and SNP technologies and the value of those technologies around traceability, parentage, genomic evaluations, traits all coming and being available in a very succinct bundle. However, equine is just slightly behind in that, particularly within the thoroughbred world. Although the non-thoroughbreds have made significant inroads into using genomic and SNP technologies. And when I say there's been a paradigm moment, governing organizations such as the International Society of Animal Genetics have recently approved SNP panels for equine, which will enable or facilitate the equine community to move from what is traditional microsatellite or STR panels, which your listeners may be familiar with. There is a more smaller type molecular bundle package of markers that's primarily used for parentage and identification only. But now with SNP technology being approved or recommended by organizations such as ISAG, for equine, that will facilitate, let's say, an emergence or uptake of genomics within the equine world. So it's a bit of a watch this space kind of story for equine, as the equine community is now going to start, I suppose, traveling the journey that the bovine community traveled some 10 plus 15 years ago within the genomic technology space.
It's quite an interesting evolution, Paul. To give our listeners a bit of an idea of scale, I think you mentioned 100,000 samples coming in a month in your peak calving season there. And that's about the level of genotyping that Angus Australia does in a year. So that's quite a bit of capability you've got, Paul. So good to know that if we get some good growth, we can handle it.
Yeah, it's quite the number, right? It's 100,000 a week is in fact what the volume is. That's obviously a peak piece, and it's a very intense period of time. But it demonstrates what is the art of the possible with this technology.
No, that's excellent. And we've had the World Angus Forum in the last year, and we've had the pleasure of some visitors from the UK and Ireland come down here. What's your relationship like with Angus in the UK and Ireland? I guess you're you'd be one of the key providers of genomic technologies, especially across the UK. Yeah, how does that work in terms of the same way that you work with Angus Australia? Is it slightly different?
So it's very much aligned, Scott. But you're correct. We work with a lot of key industry stakeholders within the UK, key cattle societies, inclusive of UK Aberdeen Angus. And we're proud to be able to talk to our partnership and journey with those various cattle societies in the UK. And we've been part of a journey whereby we have helped those cattle societies embrace genomic technologies and leverage and utilize and leverage the value from those technologies. And those journeys can be, you know, they come in all types of flavors and stories, Scott, but what is an overarching theme is, you know, it's been such a long legacy with these cattle societies. We've been very often in the door and supporting them at a level where the technology was just being utilized in the first instance. And I mentioned technologies such as microsatellites or STRs, which was ultimately the first type of DNA technology that was in place where you could look at approximately 20 genetic markers at an economic and commercial price point for parentage identification and traceability. And a lot of cattle societies, just like the equine world, utilized that DNA technology probably in the early 2000s, so 25 years ago, to be able to set up the first herd books and complement the recording of their pedigrees using that technology. So we provided that microsatellite technology and that kind of first sense of DNA testing for a lot of the UK cattle societies. And, you know, as the technology matured and evolved to what we now know as SNP technology, so, you know, we have SNP array technologies, which is the single nucleotide polymorphisms or points in the genome that are of interest. And when we talk about microarrays, we're moving from 20 genetic markers on STRs to potentially tens of thousands of these genetic markers. So that's for example, our Versa 85,000K SNP chip, and we can talk about that later on. But that journey of being able to migrate or move cat societies across from STRs, microsats to SNP microarrays, and then being able to leverage the value of those technologies. We've been part of that journey in supporting those Catholic societies to onboard latest technologies and realize the value of them. And specifically with Aberdeen Angus UK, we were really fortunate to partner there. And that partnership is in excess of 5 years now, whereby the early days of that partnership saw the onboarding of Aberdeen Angus UK starting to utilize SNP microarray densities, so up to the 50K, 85K SNP microarray densities as part of our service offerings, and then in tandem being able to generate the likes of the important genomic aspects for Angus in terms of identification panels and genomic evaluations and trait markers of specific use, such as I mentioned earlier on the POLD and the myostatin. So we've been, I guess maybe to answer your questions, we've been very much involved and part of that support journey for the UK Catholic societies.
Mm. No, that's fantastic. We've certainly heard some good feedback from our sister organisations over there. What does, as you start to work with Angus, what's the significance of a relationship with the Aberdeen Society, mainly for Weatherby's?
Yeah, I think there's a mutual respect there. When we kicked off with that history, that legacy, that 250 years our side, the 150 years plus your side. So we see that being it's an important coupling between when you take those two legacies and pedigrees. It's key for us to partner with similar minded breed societies and organizations. So I think it's very much what we're about, both sides. So I think the partnership makes a lot of sense.
Right. Paul, you're the head of research and development at Weatherby. So I guess you're the front man in terms of making change going forward. What are some of the trends that you're seeing? And if you had to go forward 5 or 10 years, what would you see over the horizon? How do you think innovation will change DNA processing?
Yeah, so I suppose trends, when we think about our market space, and maybe just to stay within the vein of bovine genomics, the trends from a sample volume perspective is that the numbers are just only increasing year on year. There has now been a period that has passed whereby genomics is now taken as it's proven. The deliverables are there to see. And with that, it is now in a place where the sample volumes, the uptakes for genomics is really starting to expand. We're seeing that across the board, and specifically, even within cattle production numbers in Angus, we can see those numbers continuing to spike, and then with that coupled to the need for genomic technology. So the sample volumes are increasing. With that, though, of course, the technology is also evolving, and how much data is generated per animal as well. So you've got this accumulating effect of large sample volumes, large number of genomic data points per sample, and you have a large volume of data sets. So with that, there's the opportunity and there's the challenges all in one. The opportunity, of course, being what can be further mined from this data. We already are very familiar with applications within our standard service offerings, and you'd be very well familiar from an herd book management perspective, the value of genomics being around identification, parentage verification, genomic evaluations, trait markers of importance. That's nearly just a standard hat given at the moment now. But more data being generated, it's about what more can be mined from that data to interrogate the data, interrogate it efficiently, and see what can be gleaned from it that can feed back into breeding programs, or even better, the breeding objectives of whatever the cattle breed societies may wish towards, to steer towards. So there's a lot of data there. It's about how to manage it and how to interrogate it. I think, you know, it's an exciting space from an IT tools perspective, when we think about AI and how that could potentially enhance the interrogation of that data, considering the huge volumes of it. But all that, you know, the caveats in place around algorithms will need to be tailored, tweaked and whatnot. But AI is probably one to watch there as well, about how it can enhance the discovery of various data sets. And who knows what that'll reveal in terms of, yes, we talk about opportunity of these discoveries. That then is about how those discoveries are managed, and maybe that's the question mark challenges. And you know, we see genetic traits even within the bovine world being discovered at a more ever increasing rate. And it's about, okay, maybe this isn't an initial fear factor. We now have realized that there's a genetic trait that has a particular undesirable phenotype discovered in a breed. This is going to only start happening more and more now that we can interrogate data so much more easily. There's so much more data out there, so. Probably about understanding how we manage those discoveries. It's not all about maybe a fear factor. It's about an education piece that those discoveries can be utilized in a manner to ensure that breeding objectives or breeding management is tailored to adhere to what the best outcome for those discoveries is. In terms of technology, then, Scott, you mentioned how that could possibly evolve, and I've already kind of touched upon the journey of microsatellites and SDRs being 20 genetic data points 25 years ago, and the cost point of that was doable. And now we're in a space where the cost price point of an 85k 1,000 SNP chip is doable. What's coming next around technology? And we hear and we see a lot about sequencing technologies which are currently in play. But how they might fit or sit into the industry, is it a case that you're not just looking at 85,000 genetic SNPs across what is a 3 billion unit genome? Are you sequencing the approximately 3 billion, whole 3 billion unit genome of each individual cow? That's a huge step forward. And, you know, what the timeline on that is who knows what and when. So it's probably just one maybe to watch. And I think, if somebody had asked me the same question, Scott, 5 years ago, I would have said SNP arrays would be gone and sequencing would be here as in today, but that's not been the case. Sequencing is pushed out, and SNP arrays very much remain as a steadfastly robust means of carrying out genotyping, given those 85,000 SNPs of very specific requirements in nature in a very economically viable package. So, yeah, and furthermore, coupled with SNP array technology, if I had to kind of make an argument, it's here to stay for the here and now. We're seeing a significant level of investment from key manufacturers for those technologies. So we talk about key manufacturers for SNP array technologies. We have stakeholders such as Illumina and Thermo Fisher Scientific. We offer both those platforms within Weatherby Scientific. And what we see from those manufacturers and feedback from them is that they're continuously investing in SNP array technologies and how their instrumentations can even be better, faster, quicker, and cheaper. So we have that support of longevity of product coming from the grassroots manufacturers too. So I think as much and all as I'd like to say, there's lots of shiny technologies coming down the line, and yet time will tell, and they'll come in time. But the here and now is we're in a very robust space with the likes of technologies such as SNP microarrays.
And Paul, it's probably a good jumping off point then to just talk about your current panel. What does your current panel look like? So if you step back and you're thinking of one of our seed stock Angus stud breeders, what distinguishes your, your 100K chip from others? There's a few differences there, isn't there, than maybe some of the others on the market?
Yeah, so I think maybe if we just step back to some of our headline capabilities as a genotyping service provider, as outlined, Weatherby Scientific is that multi-species genotyping service provider. So we have a capability with bovine, equine, ovine. We even do companion animals, so canine as well, and even aqua. shrimp within the aqua space. So we have a kind of a cross species capability around genotyping. We have that high throughput piece that I outlined as well from the earlier on in our talk about being able to process a large volume of samples, and also within a low turnaround time. So we aspire to having as lean as possible turnaround times. So they are times from date of sample receipt in the laboratory to data being returned back to the relevant databases or evaluation centers. Also, Scott, within that service offering, the manufacturer equipment aspects that I mentioned earlier on, the Illumina, the Thermo Fisher Scientific, they provide equipment or instruments to facilitate the processing of these genotyping workflows that we perform in house here, whether it be scientific, and we have multiple units of those equipment. So there's a contingency there. If one of those boxes go down, we're not dead in the water. We can pivot, and we can keep the show goes on, essentially having that instrumentation contingency. Sample types, we can take a range of sample types. So we have, for example, typically tissue samples, hair samples, blood samples, and we can also facilitate more minor team samples such as semen and swabs. We have a various range of DNA extraction capabilities to facilitate whatever type of sample is coming at us and be able to process them into high volume requirements. Then specifically to your question on the bovine chip, the bovine SNP chip that we utilize for the likes of the Angus Australia service is our Versa 85K SNP chip. That SNP chip essentially will provide genome-wide coverage across the 29 autosomal chromosomes on the bovine genome and also the sex chromosomes, where you have this very mindful sprinkling of SNPs across each chromosome to ensure that there's a coverage, or we're capturing a coverage across the chromosome, but we're looking at areas that are of known informativeness within the bovine genome, and specifically across both Taurus and Indicus breeds. So for example, we know that when we look at the 85K SNP chip, that it has a high level of informativeness for breeds like Angus across the markers that we've selected across each individual chromosome at the bovine genome. And ultimately, that informativeness drives genetic variation and all washes up to ensure that you have the most accurate testing means or data set that can be utilized for your evaluation or analysis purposes at the back end of your process. So the Versa is generating a lot of informative, valuable data. And within that, then not just this random sprinkling across the bovine genome, there are very niche panels too. So I mentioned organizations such as the International Society of Animal Genetics earlier on in the call. And that organization oversees the standardization of genotyping panels across multiple species, of which bovine is one. So that there, as I recommend, a panel of particular markers, and also that those panels have to be called in a particular nomenclature. So we ensure that when we genotype an animal here, whether it be scientific or bovine animal, and the profile for that animal can be transferred, or the Isaac profile at the very least can be transferred in a manner that is everyone is talking the same language. When if the profile is transferred from Australia to America to Ireland or whatnot, it's all standardized. So we adhere to those standards, and that we are a rank one laboratory for ISAG and the generation and transfer of those type profiles. Outside of the niche panels and profiles, then we have those trait specific markers that I mentioned there as well too. So we can, you know, we have a panel of markers to cover the likes of the developmental duplication, the myostatins. We have the complete 9 myostatins if required, and we then also cover coat color markers, both at a black and a red base coat color, and then sometimes the nature of biology is complex, and you will always find some genetic traits, for example, fawn calf, curly calf. These are really complex markers whereby SNP chip technology just sometimes is just not a fit for it. And it's very often by putting your hands up and recognizing that and being able to develop alternative technologies, which we have for some of our more complex mutations like fawn calf, curly calf, where they are, and nature has done a really amazing job of making this as molecularly biologically complex as possible. But we develop standalone tests to ensure we can test them in accuracy. And coupled with all that, then Scott, to anchor it, we outside of the ISAG, we also have ISO 17025 accreditation. So that is essentially a standard whereby we, as a laboratory, undertake processes that are documented in line with a regulatory authority within the laboratory space to ensure that we're adhering to those regulations, and we have a supporting quality management system that aligns with and supports the processing of all samples that, for example, are for set 85K bovine SNP chip.
That's interesting. Well, you must live and breathe this space. Paul, how do you keep up with the advancements, that you've just described?
Yeah, look, and it's a never-moving space. I suppose a lot of it is driven by what you as a customer need, what your customers need, what your members need, what industry sees on the ground. And we very much value the voice of our customers and industry, because ultimately that's what our products need to be tailored towards, is their here and now and future needs. So on the side, we're obviously watching scientific publications. We then do also leverage, we have a scientific advisory board here at Wetherby Scientific, of which two external sitting members are Professor Donna Berry, who works here in Chagask, and also Professor Dorian Garrick from New Zealand, Massey University. So both subject matter experts within genomics, and we meet as often as possible, whereby we drain each other's minds and we put it all together in terms of that scientific expertise. And how that could potentially fit into our future development and technology roadmap efforts, and ensuring that that's focused on our ultimate customer needs, and that it will work commercially as well. That this the technology here is so vast and broad that we could have a space where we develop something that, yes, it gives everything. However, the price point is too fat, and the service turnaround time is too long, and it just doesn't fit the industry needs. So we have to be ensure that whatever we're designing is tailored for and not just the magic science, but it also fits from a commercial perspective too.
That's interesting. This is a jump sideways, Paul. There's a big chatter in the industry about the use of AI. How is that going to fit with the future of genomic testing? Is there a role there, Paul, do you think at all?
Yeah, good, yes. Big chatter about AI in general. And I think maybe if I was quick enough on my computer here, I would have just got ChatGPT to answer the question.
That's right.
But I think from a genomics perspective, there's a huge opportunity there. Back to that point of there being so much data generated across sample volumes and increasing data sets. It's about how AI can automate the management, the interrogation, the data mining, and utilizing annotated databases that are already in situ. So we have annotated databases, but what I mean by that is there are genetic databases that are in existence across species, whereby there are known points of the genome that are either quantitatively associated with or point out specific regions of the genome that are of known phenotype or SNP effect. So there's a huge amount of opportunity there that the quicker all that can be linked up to having genotypes, having databases, having acrotype phenotypes and algorithms that you can rely on, and potentially AI pulling all that together in a very kind of automated manner, that can drive those kind of discoveries. But it's the rate of the discoveries you mentioned earlier on, but again, it's kind of, the caveats are, just I suppose, like an AI in general, it's the accuracy of it. And obviously that'll become better, but the fundamental algorithms behind that will be instrumental. But I think in a world where I think I saw something there around, you know, even in human medicine, there's already kind of like, I think 40 exabytes of data being generated in 2025, and then it's just an unfathomable amount of data. So, you know, any tool that can help to drive the rate of the means of management and interrogation of that data in a reliable manner will definitely help. And specifically, you know, the value there would be to drive genomic gain and the rate of genetic discoveries.
Interesting. Paul, you live and breathe this. This is your whole career. What excites you about the future of livestock genetics going forward?
So I think it's that rate of discovery. You know, it's how the technology is evolving. That discovery piece, how those discoveries then can be taken on board and applied into breeding programs, and how the changes of, let's say, potential changes of breeding programs is communicated to possibly farmers, or whoever the endpoint user is, and communicate the pros and cons, the fear factors, the best ways of approaching things in terms of education, and seeing it maybe from a perspective of there's long-term gain here, and not maybe to get too worried about the short-term potential pain, if that's tolerable. So, you know, a lot of discoveries may bring that fear factor. However, there is the long-term gain, that's there too. And ultimately, what excites one about this, the future livestock, is being able to pull all these technologies together and ultimately feed into that greater global objective of being able to create a more sustainable food chain for what is an ever-growing global population. So, you know, that's exciting to be part of that piece. And then, you know, just as a general industry, we have the research organizations and the initiative of those ongoing research organizations. And it's admirable to see how they operate, and they ultimately just self-fuel this model of discovery and applications, and those mission statements as outlined around greater global sustainability and food chain resilience, and keeping us all alive.
That's excellent. Just to change tack slowly, probably back to the Weatherby's company. You probably read a book or know of the author Jim Collins. He wrote the book Built to Last, Good to Great. Weatherby's is really one of those stories, isn't it? Weatherby's is a fantastic, very old company with a lot of history there, and you've had great success in a number of fields. What, Paul, are some of the values? And you work, I imagine you work closely with the family. You are certainly on the board of directors. What are some of those values that you have at Weatherby's that are important to the company?
So, Scott, values and that 250 year history legacy. I think you don't get that far as a business without having some really solid values. And if any jumped in my mind immediately in terms of the Weatherby's business, you know, over that 250 years and even to present day and our current operating ethos, we very much value trust, very much value integrity and governance. They're key values that have stuck to us over those 2.5 centuries and continue to stand to us as well. And I suppose I'm up with the business myself some 20 odd years as well, starting in 2002. So more 24 years. And I think I'd like to think that some of those values have rubbed off myself as well personally too, and you know, bring it into my everyday work life and also the team here. But the value of a family as well. You know, I think we're a family business. We're a seventh generation family business. That has stood to us as well. And again, yeah, even for myself, I can talk to those values as well. And family being a huge one too, personally. Father of five young, vibrant children. Wow. And so myself and my wife, Claire, are very much enjoying family life values too.
And Paul, there's a bit of pressure there, as I imagine working in such an old company, there's a pressure to to keep the institution strong. And I guess you feel the weight of it, but also it must be quite encouraging. So I'm really glad to hear that your values align and that family value you talked about, that we often talk about in Australia, Angus family. It's mentioned a lot, and in essentially our breed is made up by family cow calf operators, commercial seed stock, they're family businesses. So I'm sure many of them will be quite pleased to hear that. Paul, you've just had a little short trip to Australia of a couple of weeks, I think, and what's some of your observations of the Australian beef industry? You can be cheeky here if you like. Paul, you might you've come over, you've had a quick snapshot. What's any messages that you'd have for our breeders? Any observations?
Yeah, look, it was great to get over and down under and see how you guys do it in the Southern Hemisphere. I think Scott, look, it's very impressive. It was admirable to be able to talk to various breeders across various cattle societies and all teams of breeds of cattle. And just to see how progressive the general community and industry is within genomic technologies and utilizing the technologies for, let's say, the breeding objectives or evaluations, and how those members are embracing the onboarding of the technologies, how they understand it. I had more people explain it to me rather than me explaining it the other way around. There's just a huge understanding there of the technologies, the capabilities of the technologies, and the value of the technologies. So that was really admirable to see. And I think the common theme of many conversations I had with farming members and industry stakeholders was the opportunity versus the challenges, and it's getting a case of it's focus. And there's an acknowledgement there to follow proven data-driven solutions and an appreciation that all the gains that genomics make are permanent, they're compound, they're kind of iterative, and they're inheritable. So that's all very much in clear awareness. Mm. To everyone I talked to, so again, really, really admirable, and it was great to see an appreciation for that, and also everything down as far as the detail of the complete value chain and an understanding of that yes, the genotype is one piece, but so are the phenotypes and the importance of the phenotypes and the means of how phenotypes being generated, the standardization of those, the standardized manner in which they're captured, again, that appreciation that the whole value chain has to come together for it to work. So yeah, that was my kind of general good feel factor I got from on the ground. But great to see you're definitely you've hit the ground running on it and very much aligned with how we're utilizing and embracing the technology in the Northern Hemisphere.
No, that's great. Great to hear, Paul. Now you've covered a few principles already, but would there be any unique business principles that you think that you're aware of that could apply to some of our seed stock businesses in Australia from your Weatherbiz experience?
I think it's just that piece around so much to consider, but taking it back to that focus and data-driven decisions that are ultimately working towards your breeding goals. It's to understand clearly what your breeding goals are, and then understanding what data can be used to drive towards those breeding goals. And I think that's very important to find that, and just they're the metrics and the parameters that are focused on. Yeah, I think that there's probably several other principles there that we've discussed, but if I had to maybe call out one, that data-driven vision is we've seen that being key to a lot of breed organizations over the years.
That's great. Excellent. Now you've got, I believe you've got also a cheeky South African that works for you. How should they contact Weatherbiz in Australia, Paul, if people are interested in talking with Weatherbiz or one of your representatives there? What's the best way they can get in touch with Weatherbiz?
Yeah, so look, we have Mike, no worries. You've referenced Cheeky South African, yes. And he's on the ground here for sure. But and also supported by Tamara Luxton, here in Australian territory. No, we're always happy to engage. I think what we see works well over the years across various members and organisations and societies is that if you have, let's say, a member of Angus Australia has a query, that query is placed with the Angus Australia Society. And we then, you know, as a partnership, are always very, very happy to liaise with Angus Australia and address that query and work in a manner that we come up with the right answer or solution, and ultimately then Angus Australia can get back to the member with the relevant answer or proposal. So that we see as a framework works well, and ultimately keeps everyone in the loop there too, inclusive of the society, and we bring all the kind of necessary stakeholders into place to ensure we get the correct answer back to whoever that query initiator was in the first instance. But overarchingly, always happy to engage and support.
No, that's great. Well, always ask the people that come on our podcast here, what's your best beef eating experience? This is a bit of a loaded question after you've just been to Australia.
I better tread cautiously here. So I think loaded. I expect the answer has to be Angus based of some sort. So I think just back to that family piece again, you know, it's amazing how food and family often go hand in hand. And I've many great family memories of childhood, Sunday roast, beef dinners, and continue to do so in my own family. So, you know, that's always a kind of that makes for a happy dinner table banter. And then you look, as you said, Scott, been down with you guys recently and specifically enjoyed my time in Armidale. I'd absolutely have to call out a recent beef eating experience whereby we visited Shane Ross and his restaurant, in the Cottage restaurant in Armidale, where I really enjoyed the experience there. And it was admirable to see how Shane and his team, you know, they take pride in sourcing, preparing and serving. And what was a fabulous beef eating experience there at the restaurant. So yeah, it would be irrevis for me not to call that one out. That was very enjoyable.
That's great, Paul. Shane runs a wonderful restaurant there in Armidale, and he used to be cheeky. He puts premium New England Scotch fillet on the menu so that if he entertains somebody from Angus and Tangus, and perhaps it's Hereford, if it's a Hereford guy, but whenever we're there, he certainly sources wonderful local beef, which tells me he's Angus, and it's a wonderful restaurant there. So if anyone's in Armidale, they should definitely try Shane out with his wonderful customer service as well. Any books, any great reads that you can think of that you'd recommend? We've got a lot of business owners and managers, all types of people listen to the podcast. All anything good from the other side of the globe?
Yeah, I suppose. Maybe knowing your endpoint audience, and if we want to stick with a bovine farming theme, one I enjoyed here, it's a national written book. It's called the Cow Book, written by John Connell here in I think John comes from Banalee, County Longford in Ireland, whereby that would be the Midlands of the country, so real potential farming country. And the theme of the story, really, I'm trying to recall here now, but the theme of the story is that John would have emigrated, I think it was to Sydney, came back then to support on the family farm back to Ireland, and lands, I think, right in the middle of calving season, you know, and this is a very new experience for John, from what I recall. And ultimately, John beautifully describes the highs and lows of calving season, you know, and it's just it's a lovely read in that sense. And it also talks to, from what I recall, the family relationship and how farming is entwined with that, and you know, there's lovely moments of how he describes the the conversations with his father. And, you know, I can so resonate with my own dad that there'd be sometimes very few words said, but when they are, they really hit home, you know? So, yeah. And it's kind of there's a sprinkling of humor throughout as well, throughout the whole book as well. So look, I really enjoyed the cow book. If your listeners can get your hands on in Australia, it'd be one I would recommend.
Well, I think that's the best answer we've had to that question on the podcast. I think you just took the trophy, Paul. So I'm an avid reader and I haven't read the book, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm sure a few others will as well. So we appreciate the recommendation. That's very good. Very good. Mate, is there anything you'd just like to mention to our Angus breeders in Australia before we finish up?
Yeah, I think it was great to have recently visited the territory. It's an exciting piece now that Weatherby Scientific are starting to offer some service offerings to Angus Australia. We'd expect that it'd be very much standard hat status quo as we've been servicing your sister organizations up Northern Hemisphere and other themed cattle societies. So we expect it to be seamless in that sense. And also then looking forward to everything we've discussed across the podcast of how the technology is going to potentially evolve and how Weatherby Scientific can be a part of that journey with Angus Australia and your members to onboard advancements within those technologies and leverage it to make it even better and whatever that may be, maybe more data or more commercially feasible. But obviously to stay close to those parameters and ensure that they work for all the stakeholders, be it that Angus Australia as a society, your members, and Weatherby Scientific, and we're all traveling a very aligned path. What the future needs to look like.
Well, look, thank you very much for a couple of things, but thank you for visiting us at Angus Australia for Weatherby's willingness to enter into a partnership, and we thank you for spending time with our members today. It was lovely to meet you in person. Great to do the podcast today. And I look forward to the day where we can have a pint of Guinness together again. Paul, we did try in Australia, but the tap was dry at the pub we went to. So we'll look forward to having a Guinness in the future.
Absolutely. We might even try and get you up this side of the world, Scott. And let's share a Guinness. And one thing for sure, it'd be unlikely the tap would be dry up in Ireland.
Yeah, I'm sure that they keep them well supplied. Thanks for joining the Angus table today, Paul.
Thank you, Scott, for the opportunity to do so.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg. Until next time, all the best.